No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Or you can Skype us at BBSRADIOONE. Tonight, we have a special guest, but first, Maria and I are going to talk about what's going on in the world because there's so much going on in America right now. We're approaching the two Democratic conventions. Of course, we've had this terrible tragedy in Dallas, and there are a lot of other things that we want to discuss. And then in the second half of the show, we're going to bring on Gary Byrne, a former uniformed Secret Service agent who's just written a book called Crisis in Character about presumptive Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton, and we'll hear what he has to say. But first, let me introduce my co-host and good friend, Maria Sanchez. Maria, are you there?
I'm here, Michael. Thank you so much for your kindness, as always. And yes, retired Secret Service officer Gary Byrne, he's going to be our guest at the bottom of the hour. And you do want to hear this because there's lots of controversy that's going on. And I would like to share with our listeners that Michael and I are on opposite ends of the political spectrum in some ways, but we're probably more alike than we're not, I would suggest, Michael. Me being a liberal Republican and you being probably, I guess you're a liberal Democrat, but we agree fiscally, it seems, and more socially, though. So to your credit, when I suggested Gary as a guest on our program, Michael's a superdelegate. He has is voting for Secretary Clinton. And he said, I'm going to say things, I won't be vulgar and I will be polite, but I've got some questions to ask. And I said, of course. And I want our listeners to know how open-minded I found that of you, that you're willing to engage at least in the conversation, because some folks, left and right, only want to hear what they know to be true. And they don't want to be challenged, or they don't want to know that another point of view exists or recognize it or even entertain it. So I think that's a marvelous about you. And that's probably why you've been so successful for so many decades.
Well, thanks, Maria. And, you know, I feel deeply about that, as you know, because we've talked about it before. And that was one of the reasons we started this show, is we really want to hear both sides. You know, we really want, there's some really, really tough problems facing America that we cannot solve unless we come together and solve them. One of them, of course, is the issue of guns. As long as we have people on one side that say you nobody can have a gun, and people on the other side that say you can have any kind of gun you want and there should be no regulations, and we refuse to meet somewhere in the center, we're never going to work this controversy out. We need to be able to sit down with each other and respect each other's position, respect the fact that people have a right under the Second Amendment to bear arms, and that people also have a right to keep their children and loved ones protected. We're never going to get anywhere. That's just one of those issues that I'd like to see some compromise on. And given that, I think
Well, may I say, systemically, getting my master's degree in clinical psychology, we always talk about homeostasis, and that's where the system wants to stay the same. It doesn't want to change because change creates change. Change is threatening. Change is scary. And but without change, nothing evolves. And so we as Americans need to consider some changes because something's not working.
Yeah.
And so whatever that means, whatever that looks like, change is inevitable or else we are going to go down as a society. And I don't mean, you know, doom and gloom. I just mean we're not going to be the greatest country in the world if we don't fix our problems. And that is going to require change.
Right. And absolutely. And, you know, if we don't talk to each other, we don't, we not only can't make change, we really have no sense of what's going on. I mean, look at what happened in England over their exit from the UK. It came as a surprise to a lot of people.
Exactly.
Because, you know, because there, I think part of that problem wasn't, there wasn't an open dialogue about it. And, you know, as I said with the gun issue, we've got to come to some resolution. And we've seen it once again rear its ugly head in this terrible, terrible, terrible thing that's happened in Dallas where these police officers were ambushed. They were ambushed. And I think that, you know, the thing that I find most hurtful about this beside the fact that five innocent officers have died, and or last time I checked, there may be more because I know there were 12 of them that were shot, and some of them are still in the hospital. But also that, you know, it seemed to me that given the nature of the protest, which was about some police shootings, that the police really stepped up to the plate by taking off their body armor, wearing their summer uniforms to try to be less. To appear less aggressive and to be less insightful, and then something terrible like this happens to them. Some of those people might have been saved if they had been more heavily protected, but they made that choice to come out in public and put a good face on who they are.
In solidarity.
Right.
But then we have just last night 21 officers in Minnesota. Law enforcement agencies were injured at a protest that turned violent last night.
Yeah.
So, to me, I mean, talk about a breakdown in the system in terms of respect and dignity. I mean, if our police, peace officers aren't safe, no one's safe.
Right. And we need to stand up for that principle. We need to stand up for the principle of the rule of law and to protect these people that stand up for us. I truly believe that. And the only thing violence begets is more violence on both sides. You know, I'm not somebody that necessarily wants to stand up and be a spokesperson for law enforcement. But it's essential to having an orderly society, and we need to stand up as a community and say enough is enough. We can't ask these people to go out and put their lives on the line and not stand up for them. So I hope that the country will come together in solidarity around police officers as well as victims of police brutality.
Right.
I mean, those are both issues, and we need to talk about both of them. You know, and that's one thing that really bugs me about the whole incident where the young man was shot and his girlfriend videotaped the thing on the cell phone. I want to know where the National Rifle Association is. This guy had a carry permit, and he reached in his back pocket to get his driver's license, and the officer shot him, said he had a gun. The officer shot him several times, and the NRA has said nothing about it. I want to tell you, if the guy had been white, they would have had plenty to say.
So may I ask you, Michael, because we haven't spoken specifically about how you feel both personally and professionally, because I know that you've been mentioning through social outlets that you want to do and make legislation different. What in you, if there was a panacea, what would it be? What does that look like to you?
Well, you know, it's not an area, Maria, in which I'm an expert, but I got to say that I thought the District of Columbia had a great gun law, which has been overturned by the Supreme Court, and we're searching for new gun laws. But, you know, in the district, anybody could own a shotgun. If you wanted to protect your family or your property or, you know, yourself, you could own a shotgun. Nobody had a carry permit. There were no automatic weapons. I think there are probably, you know, special incidences in which you can have automatic weapons. And there ought to be a process for applying for that. I mean, if you want to go to a gun range and shoot an automatic weapon because you think it's fun, great. Let's license gun ranges to keep and secure those weapons. You don't have to bring your own weapon. When I go to the bowling alley, I rent shoes. You don't need to, you know what I mean? Come and shoot your
have
gun
at
and leave it.
It
there. You know, and I think that, you know, we just have to sit down and have a dialogue. But I recognize that people, you know, feel strongly about this on both sides. So I'd like to see some just basic things that we all seem to agree on, like background checks. We all seem to agree on that, but gun owners and non-gun owners. But we, you know, we see members of Congress having a sit-in a few weeks ago because they can't get the simplest rules on background checks and other things passed. And I think
it seems to me that you put together the brightest of the bright and make a subcommittee and say, and from both sides of the aisle, and say, we need to compromise. So how are we going to compromise? And what is that compromise going to look like? Because we need to do something because the system isn't working. No one can argue with that. You can't argue with the fact that assault rifles are being used and that guns seem to be proliferating in their violence, and we must do – and again, being on the right, being a Republican, my dad's NRA, I was raised with guns. There were guns all over my house. I've never owned a gun. My dad taught me how to shoot a gun at a target practice out in the wild with nature. He used to be a hunter until we started sobbing when he would bring home the prey, and he stopped that. So it's a part of my culture, but it's not a part – I don't want to partake in the culture, but I was raised by the culture. So I understand the mindset, but we didn't have what we have now back in the day.
Well, that's right. And you know what? That's another thing. I mean, it's funny, you know, we've got you, the Republican – arguing for this, and I feel the same way. I was raised around guns. I haven't owned a gun, and the reason I don't own a gun is because I had children, and I always worried about that. I remember accidental shootings and things like that, and I certainly didn't want one. I have a big friendly dog. That's my home protection system. But I think we also have to realize that us all having access to guns, nobody in my high school walked in and started shooting people, even though they had access to guns. The kind of incidences of mass shootings that we see today, we didn't hear of when I was, in high school or when I was younger. And so I think we have to realize that it's not just guns, because guns have always been there. Something else in society has changed too. Right. And that's what, as liberals, I think we need to understand. We need to address this problem on many different levels, not just the level on let's lock up all the guns, because, as gun advocates say, and it is true, you know, there's 300 million guns in America. You can't go and collect them all. So to deal with the problem effectively, we're going to have to deal with issues like mental illness, We're going to have to deal more effectively with those things.
But you know what's interesting about that? Because as you were talking, I was thinking about, you know, like Los Angeles is doing a huge investment in the homeless population, billions of dollars with housing and services and all that's been started up this year. And but then I was then thinking about the perpetrators of those last most heinous events. One, the one that just happened in Dallas, and two, Orlando. Ostensibly, those were contributing members of society. They were functioning. This fellow in Dallas had served our country in the armed forces. The man in Orlando had a family that, you know, somehow they weren't on our radar, really. And that's what's more problematic to me, is it's not this knee-jerk, well, here you go, this is the profile. Once you get that, then you know that you've got trouble and we'll take their gun and then we won't have trouble. There's no quick solution.
Yes, absolutely. There is no quick solution, and that's part of the problem. And you know, we see that, and we see that with other issues as well. We see that there are no quick solutions, and that just exacerbates things when we refuse to sit down and try to work out the more difficult long-term solutions. But
Michael, perhaps you can share with our listeners, since you are in the eye of the beast, and what most of us know is what we read. You actually are in the halls and walking around and rubbing elbows and stuff. Why is it that Paul Ryan won't bring forth the legislature?
Well, I think that it's merely, you know, it's politics in its purest sense. I think that, you know, you've got an election year and the politicians don't want to touch this issue. You know, we have strong liberal Democrats, for example. A friend of mine, Mark Warner, a guy I used to work with from Virginia, he doesn't want to touch the gun issue. Republicans certainly don't want to touch the gun, you know, make it look like they're running afoul of the NRA. So, of course, the perfect political dodge is to table things, to not move them, to not get them, not put yourself in a position where you need to take a public statement, where you need to make a public statement that may put you on the wrong side of a very powerful force. And that force is not only the NRA, but gun owners who are many of whom are very politically active. I think most gun owners believe in you know, we've seen through surveys, for example, they believe in background checks, but nobody wants to take on the National Rifle Association on either side of the issue, and that's a problem. Only when we stand up together are we going to be able to deal with forces like that, I believe.
So because it's so divisive, people don't want to be on the record in an election year, is the paraphrasing.
Right.
Okay. So
right.
Will it serve us to roll up our sleeves and take off our coats and loosen our ties? And I don't mean that to be sexist, but, just to get down to work, it's always going to be divisive.
It's always going to be divisive. So we need to have the intestinal fortitude, the courage to stand up as a country and say enough is enough. And certainly we're getting to that point. You know, we're seeing, I think we're seeing this build into a crescendo when you have things like Newtown and then Orlando and Aurora and Virginia Tech and this thing in Dallas and Minnesota. As these things grow, I think the public becomes more disconcerted and has more of a motivation to stand up together. At least I hope they do.
I was reading the paper today, and it's like every story now is something about something's wrong, something's broke. I know that if it bleeds, it leads. I understand that that's what news is about. I've been a news anchor and reporter. But where's the good news? I started a good news television station about 5 years ago, couldn't get any traction because there was no controversy.
Well, you know, isn't that, it's so funny that you should say that, because I have a good friend named Susan who wanted to start a good news publication. She said, and said exactly what you said, Maria. I'm so sick of picking up the newspaper, turning on the TV and seeing nothing but bad news. You know, she says, I know there's good news out there. There's positive things happening, and I'd like to report on it. And that, you know, after I thought about it for a while, that was my conclusion. And I said, yeah, it's sad, isn't it? But I don't think it would get a lot of traction. I don't.
You can't monetize it.
Right.
For some reason, we're attracted to the accidents and the horror. And I mean, to me, when I read something about somebody who did a good deed or a good Samaritan or the kindness towards a stranger or paying it forward, and I get tears in my eyes, I think I'd like to hear more of that, not less. I don't want this to be the exception, the anecdote to how we sign off on our broadcast or, you know, what have you. But it is. And so I guess that maybe is the human condition, and you have to accept what is and not try and rail against it, because that's what works.
Yeah, right? Well, maybe Michael Brown and Maria Sanchez can change that a little, and we should talk about having like a good news once a month segment. Or something, you know, segment.
Well,
yeah,
we've done that a couple times. Yeah. You know, when we had the Wolf Sanctuary guy on, that was good news. Really? Because it was a win-win-win with the rehabilitation of the wolves and the folks. Remember the law enforcement people that went there to help them rehabilitate too and stuff? But yeah, I guess it's been the exception, not the norm.
Well, and you know what? It's sad, because I think the comment that you just made about how you want to hear more of it, I think we see that. And it really is all about the monetizing, because we really see that, you know, we'll see some thing about a pet, a puppy being rescued out of a pipe on the internet, and it'll have a million hits because, mm-hmm. you know, be right. Or somebody doing something really heroic, or there was a story today, and I haven't gotten to the bottom of it yet. I just saw a blurb on it, but a bunch of prisoners that escaped from a jail in Dallas, they busted out of whatever confinement they were in to save one of the jailers who was in the midst of having a heart attack.
Yep.
Right.
He said he was sitting outside the cell on a chair joshing with them, and the next thing they know, he slumped over in silence. And yeah, they broke out of that holding cell, and they said they were afraid that guns were going to be, because the person they were trying to save had a gun, so they could have taken the gun.
Right.
And no, they saved his life.
Right. And I think we all hope for more stories like that. We all want to hear about the good things that are happening in the world. And there are a lot of good, solid people out there making a difference. And that's what's always made America great, right? We've always had people like that, not only in the United States, all around the world. But here in America, I think we've had a spirit of community activism and people that help and work together. And it doesn't matter if you're, you know, some left-wing liberal out trying to, you know, clean up the environment, or some right-wing conservative trying to give better financial advice to people that are poor. I mean, there are all sorts of major things that go on in our communities, and maybe seriously, we should report on them from time to time. Maybe that would give people more hope. But
I would like that.
But
because altruism is abundant.
Yes,
that's why there's proliferation of the 501c3s. There's
exactly.
a need. Someone saw it and created an agency to fix it. And you know, for that we have to be grateful for, because that takes vision, that takes courage, that takes stamina, that takes time, resources, and there you have it. So yes, there's a lot to be grateful for, but we have Taboo on the line if you'd like to hear what he has to say.
Sure. What do you have to say, Taboo?
Hi,
Taboo,
everybody.
Hey, how are you?
Yeah, listen,
what's up?
I'm a little concerned right now.
Why?
But you know, Maria said something that really struck me. When she talked about, we have to fix our problem. And there is one problem I'm not hearing much about. Maybe it's just my circles. But is the potential of losing, of the dollar being lost as the global currency, is that not a problem? I'm concerned. We look at, what is it called, the... Asian, was AIIB, Asian, was Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank.
Mm-hmm.
If we if the dollar loses its status as a global currency, we would really, really, really be in trouble, would we not, as a country?
Well, I can't, you know, I got to admit, Tabu, it's not a subject that I know very much about, but I can't imagine that would be helpful to the United States, no. And, you know, I mean, I know that it's been a strength. The American dollar has been a strength in our economy, the fact that it has been a global currency, and the fact that more American dollars are held by foreigners than any other currency that's held by foreigners. So I know that's a real strength of our economy over the years. And I would think, yeah, that would be a problem. But you know, maybe your question should encourage Maria and I to try to find an economist,
yes,
that really can speak it intelligently to this, because I don't know. Maybe
I'm
Maria's
wondering if it's gold related or trade related or a combination thereof.
Well, our dollar is not based on gold anymore. That's a real serious problem. And the problem that we had, let's say, when President Obama came in office, did he fix it or did we just print more money? And when we print more money, well, we got something like close to $20 trillion, you know, national debt.
Yeah, my eyes roll back.
Yeah.
It's like,
and you know, as somebody that's in politics, you know, I would tell you, if you gave me a printing press that I was able to print money on, I could see where I'd want to do that a lot, you know, to resolve problems. Yeah, let's just print more money. And you know, that's something, again, as liberals, that we need to understand. It's not just about throwing money at problems. You know, we do that a lot. We do that, and I'm sure there are people out there rolling their eyes, because I always talk about how we need more money in the statehood movement, and we really do. But you can't just throw money at a problem either. And I think, you know,
well that's the thing. See,
I think
we really need. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, in looking at what money is, you know, money is whatever a person would take for a product, produce, or service rendered. But the problem that we've had when we just print money, and as you mentioned earlier, it's not based on gold. I guess it's based on trust in the dollar, or maybe it's the gross national product. I'm not sure. I'm no economist either, but I think it would be good if you had somebody on to help better educate us to understand that, because as I, as a layperson, see this, we're in serious trouble. And thank you all so much.
Thank you, Tabu. Yeah, as always,
you,
have a great week. So intelligent.
Well, we'll look for that person.
Yep.
Definitely. We'll look and see if we can find somebody that can discuss this. But
so
right now,
before Michael, we take our break. Was there anything else that you wanted to speak about in terms of the week's events?
You know, let me just shed a little good news. I had a great day on Thursday. This is a personal thing. I went to speak in front of the American Legion, which is the oldest veterans group in America, and they were training young people through a program on citizenship. And you know, I got to meet a lot of really bright, engaged, patriotic, energetic high school seniors.
Nice.
And so that made me feel good. And then I got to go to a reception for Miss USA, who just happened to be, for the first time in a long time, Miss District of Columbia. Now she's won Miss USA, and she will go on to the Miss Universe pageant. But the nicest thing about her is she's an active duty lieutenant in the United States Army. So, and that's the first time an active duty person has ever been has ever won that title. So that was a fun day. Except, of course, I took a picture with her, and she just so damn skinny that it made me look twice as fat as I think I really am. Don't stand next to skinny people and have your picture taken.
I know exactly what that's like. I did some work in Senegal it was November of 2008, and the Senegalese are these tall, lithe, elegant, very trim individuals. And I asked one of the villagers, who was a woman, to take a picture next to me. I said, because I'm not overweight at all. I'm muscular, slender-ish, athletic. But she was just this willowy, beautiful person. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to put my ego aside because you're stunning and I want to know. I want to record
this
for
posterity. I'm only taking pictures with fat people from now on. But she was beautiful and intelligent. And her dad, I talked to her dad for a while. And her dad, listen to this guy, he's a Special Forces Army. He's got 5 kids. 4 of them have gone into the military, and the youngest one is now considering it. They're officers. They're all well-educated. Wow. Misty C has a master's degree. He has one kid who is a lawyer in the service, JAG. And, you know, so I said to him upon leaving, you must be one hell of a role model,
because
they've
say.
All followed in his footsteps. So, you know what? There's still a lot of great Americans out there that still care and want to contribute to their society, to our society, and stand up for America. And now we're going to take just a few seconds to for Don to polish off his microphone and get our guest on the air, and then we'll be back with Gary Byrne. Back in a minute. Thanks. Okay, we're trying to get Gary Byrne on the line. We're having a few technical difficulties, but hopefully we'll be able to get him in a minute. And
Gary is the retired Secret Service officer that's written this book. That, by the way, Michael, it topped the New York Times bestseller list for the end of June, and I think it bested on best-selling nonfiction book at Barnes & Noble last week. So it's got some traction. It'll be interesting to see how it is that he obtained the information that he claims, because I've spoken to a man that I know that retired from the Secret Service, and he had some opinions about how he would have access to that information.
Right. Well, that's an amazing statistic you put out there about the bestseller being on the bestseller list, because the book was released on June 28th. So, if that's the case, it's obviously caught fire right away. So,
yeah, I think the pre-sales, because it was number one on Amazon for a month. So that means that it was selling before it was actually published.
Right. And now it's starting to get publicity. And I mean, that's the whole thing, is that even though it may have been out there selling, I really didn't hear it being pushed until the release date. Now I've, you know, on the internet and on some of the conservative news shows and stuff,
Hello.
I've heard about it. Hi, Gary.
This is Gary.
Yes, this is Gary. How are you?
Hello,
hey,
Gary.
Good.
Thanks
for being on our show.
Thank you.
We were just chatting while our staff was getting you, because I guess we had troubles with Skype, so we reached you. Thank goodness that your folks shared your contact information. But Gary, we were curious about how, because you've obviously created some controversy here, it's how it is that you obtained the information that you have posted into your book.
So it's it started out... The original title of the book was called Fence Jumpers to Hijackers. It was about my life. I was a former Secret Service Uniform Division officer, and then I became an air marshal. And then when I got to the point where I got a contract, the editors basically said, hey, we like that title, but we're not going to use it. So we ended up with Crisis of Character. Everything in that book has happened to me in my life. I'm the first Secret Service employee to be ever compelled to testify against the president in a criminal case, against the president in a criminal case. I was subpoenaed 6 times by Judge Starr's investigation, and then eventually ordered to testify by Supreme Court Justice Rehnquist.
Well, let
so,
me ask, yeah, let me
go, yeah, ahead. Go ahead, Michael. Marie. All
okay.
right.
But, I just want to ask. Go ahead. No, you, Marie, go. I'm sorry.
Sorry, Gary, because we both are anxious to get as much information in our time as possible. So subpoenaed six times, does that mean you refused? And that's why it kept coming and then it went up the ladder?
Well, partially, yes, that's correct. So the Secret Service, when Judge Starr came to the Secret Service, he knew he wanted certain information. And the high ups in the Secret Service, the director, the deputy directors, they were terrified about having to testify. So basically what they did is they forced the uniform division officers that worked together, that worked in the West Wing, to testify. Basically, in hindsight, they did it to save themselves. So about 20, a little over 20-some UD officers, a few agents, and then one senior agent that wasn't even on the at the White House or on the detail at the time. So to kind of protect themselves, they pushed us forward. So they got this little plan together. Now you have to realize that all the lawyers involved from the Justice Department and all the Secret Service personnel are all government employees. There was no confidentiality agreement because we're all government employees. So one side that was supposedly helping us was eating at the same steakhouse at night as the other side. And that became pretty clear later on. But we stayed, and I stayed with the program that the Secret Service had set up because I wanted to keep my job. I believed in what I did, and I believed it, you know. And I also hoped in my deep down that eventually President Clinton would decide to stand up and be a man and do the right thing and come forward and tell the truth. But eventually, and obviously he didn't do that.
Well, you know, when it comes to telling the truth, Gary, that's where I want to start. According to the information that I've read, Ken Starr's people have said that your accounts varied depending on the telling, that there were variations in your stories, and actually that you, in fact, testified under oath that much of the information that you had, or at least some of the information you had, was hearsay. And it was, and they were rumors. For example, the incident that you report in your book about Eleanor Mondale, or another story about Monica Lewinsky trying to get in through the West Gate, that you heard those, that they were rumors. And actually, the Secret Service agent that you named in the one incident with Monica Lewinsky denies that it ever happened. What about that?
So basically, everything you just said is not true. The Eleanor Mondale thing, I was standing right there in front of the map room when it happened. And as far as the testimony goes, about 3 hours of the testimony is actually public access, C-SPAN. And a good portion of that, actually it's about 4.5 hours, and a good portion of that is blacked out because of Secret Service procedures. Let me give you a little help here. Anybody in the Secret Service that was a Secret Service agent is never going to say anything positive about anybody in the uniform division. And a good portion of these stories have been told before by Secret Service agents over free steak dinners and drinks to other reporters. This is how it happened. It's in my testimony. And I'll remind you that I got where I was in the Secret Service by taking a polygraph test.
Well, you know, then tell me why. First of all, I don't understand why people... I deal with the Secret Service all the time, and I don't understand why agents wouldn't have anything decent to say about uniformed Secret Service people. I know they're both integral parts of the protection of the White House and diplomats in the District of Columbia, although the uniform division is certainly seen as subordinate to the president's detail, and that seems to be a problem too, because there are many agents that say you could have never gotten that close. But tell me why then, why does the Nonpartisan Association of Former Agents of the Secret Service, why have they released an uncharacteristic public statement that denounces your book and says you have an ulterior motive?
They did the same thing. Here's what you need to know about those guys. The Retired Secret Service Agents Association, Back during the middle of this investigation, when the subpoenas started flying and all these big, brave Secret Service agents started running for cover and pushing the uniform division guys forward, The Secret Service Agents Association came out and said basically what they just said right now, and what you're insinuating, is that the Uniform Division doesn't have access, they don't have this, they don't have that. But what the Secret Service, retired Secret Service Agents Association didn't understand was, but this is what the Secret Service was trying to do to protect themselves. So they had to go and tell these guys to shut their mouths. And because Judge Stark came back and said, well, if these guys don't know anything, then we don't want them. And you have to keep asking yourself, why was I subpoenaed six times? I went, I testified for hours, week after week after week. I told these people everything they were allowed to know. You got to remember the rules were, they changed by the week. We were allowed to talk about this, but not about that. And I did the best I could. Everything I said in those statements was true, and everything in my book is true. You also have to realize, when I write my life story, I'm not testifying. I'm telling it as I remember it. It wasn't my job to tell these investigators what to ask. As a matter of fact, I wasn't allowed to volunteer anything.
So, Michael, I just want to make a distinction here, because we all know this vernacular, but I don't think our listeners might. You keep making a distinction between the Uniform Division and the agents, all Secret Service. But as I understand it, the Uniform Division watches the buildings and the agents watch the personnel. Is that correct?
To a certain extent. Let me describe it for your listeners. So the Secret Service Uniform Division, when I was there, we were about 1,000 people. And we do all the fence, the outer perimeter, and then the inner perimeter. We do access control to the old executive office building, the treasury, the White House itself, the West Wing, the mansion. The Uniform Division has had fixed posts in the West Wing, the mansion, and the old executive office, the East Wing, for over 50 years. Those posts don't change. My post was right outside the Oval Office. I worked there. Let me put it to you this way. My base pay was about $45,000 to $50,000 a year. I never made less than $70,000 to $80,000 a year because of the overtime we worked. I was there all the time. The Uniform Division does the job of about 1,500 people with about 1,000 people. So anytime you hear anybody that's an agent that tries to tell you that I wasn't there, then I'd like to know where they were when the subpoenas were coming out, and they could have saved me a lot of headache. Everything in the book is true. Pick any, you know, actually earlier you mentioned about one of the incidents that they say I could have never seen. Remind me what that was, and I'll walk you through it.
The Eleanor Mondale.
So, Eleanor Mondale.
At the map room.
The map room. So the map room's on the ground floor of the White House. It's almost directly across from the president's elevator and the stairs that go up to the private living quarters. And it's also right across from a small office that the agents, it's one of the agents have two command posts in the White House. One's underneath that staircase and then across in the map room, and then one is over in the West Wing underneath the Oval Office, basically. So I was working that night, and it was around Christmas, and I was on a break, and I went over to the East Wing to get something to eat. So I'm walking back, and as I'm going past this area in front of the map room where there's a post, my buddy's standing there. There's an agent, at least one agent, and the officer. The officers are always there. And excuse me just a second. So the officers are always there. And the agents are only there when the first families, you know, in the residence or when the president's over in the West Wing. So I stop and I talk to these guys. Hey, how you doing? Merry Christmas. And as I'm standing there, one of the Navy stewards walks up, and in his hand he has an iron shirt, you know, a dress shirt for the president. The president, it's common for him to change his shirt, like if he's going to a function where he doesn't need a tuxedo, but he's just going to put a clean shirt on. So the steward goes into the map room because he knows the agent's there, so the president must be in the map room. And as the steward opens up the door, he's looking back at us, and we're looking in the room, and there's the president and Eleanor Mondale making out like high school seniors. They never looked up. And then the steward, looking at us, saw the look on our faces. He turned around and looked into the room and saw what he saw, the same thing. He closed the door and took off down the hallway. So that's what happened. I looked at the agent, the officer. They looked at me, and you know, we said, here we go again. And I went to my post, and that's exactly how it happened.
Well, let me ask you something, Gary. Why do we care about this? Why should care about what the president was doing when we're talking about nominating his wife for President of the United States.
The reason I wrote about it is because it's my life story. And I want to listen, there was no shortage of people trashing me and the uniform division then, and I couldn't say a word. And I knew that these senior agents that were supposed to be oh so brave were pushing us forward to protect themselves and their careers. And they shit all over us. So,
well, you know what? If that's the case, why did you wait 10 years? Why
because
did you
I
tell the story?
Because I still work for the government, and I wasn't really ready to cross that threshold yet. I thought I would never talk about this. I thought I would take it to my grave. But about a year and a half ago, it was presented to me, and I started thinking about it, and I decided to do it. And I decided it was important that people know. Because to know Bill Clinton, you have to know Hillary Clinton. And to know Hillary Clinton, you have to know Bill Clinton. When you vote in one, when the country voted Bill Clinton as president, they got Hillary. And when they vote her in, they're going to get him. And my first question to you would be, and to Mrs. Clinton would be, if she does win and he comes back into the White House, what steps are they going to take to protect women against him?
Well, you know, I don't think that that's her actual responsibility to protect women from him. And I think that...
You don't think he's a predator?
Well, I don't think that anybody's out there talking about Mrs. Trump or any of the other women.
I never worked for the Trumps. I don't know anything about the Trumps. All I know is they make a lot of money, they build big buildings, and they give a lot of money away. I work for the Clintons, and what I know about the Clintons is that he wasn't a very good leader, and she is not a leader.
Gary.
Well, wait a second, Michael, before we go in.
Okay, because this is his purview. What? That's why he's not talking about what he doesn't know.
First of all, I disagree with that. He was a better president than any Republican president that I've seen.
That's your opinion, and
you know what? And that's just a matter of opinion. But I want to know, for example, why you tell the story about Hillary Clinton shooting a machine gun, and then you try to insinuate from that she should be for the she should have been against the assault weapon ban because she enjoyed shooting an assault weapon. What the hell does that have to do with the fact that she wants to keep semi-automatic and automatic weapons out of the hands of the public?
You just said it. You said it exactly right. She wants to keep legal firearms out of the hands of the public, not criminals from the public. And two, that's not what the story's about. I told the story because it was humorous and it was funny. And it was one of the times that we were around them when she wasn't screaming and yelling and she was acting like a normal human being.
So you said something earlier, Gary, that my friend who retired from the Secret Service, an agent, said to me when he was at the White House. He said, I have stories that I will take with me to my grave because they're nobody's business. We live as when we serve in an apolitical world. It is about our charges, not about our opinions. And yet you now are not doing that. So I'm wondering about the integrity with regards to that.
Here's how that's working for me. I agree with everything you just said, and I agree with him. But where do you draw the line? Let me ask you this. If that same agent and I were on a protection detail and our protectee accidentally killed a child and it was ended up being hidden, whose child that was, would you want us to come forward? I mean, my point being is, where do you draw the line? And clearly when Mrs. Clinton was clear that she was going to run, yes, I'm afraid for the country. And this is why I'm coming forward. I'm basically saying no more of this insanity where they keep trying to prop her up as this leader, and she's not. And the best example is this last thing with the server in the State Department. It's insane to think that she can lead this country.
Well,
based on what I saw in my experiences.
Well, you know, that begs the question again, why wait 10 years? She ran
because
8 years
still,
ago.
I couldn't retire until this past March.
If your motivation is the country, and you're not motivated by any kind of self-interest or political interest.
I'm not.
She ran 8 years ago.
Right, and she lost.
You could have come out 8 years ago.
But
she
shared that.
She was.
Michael.
Look,
no
you
way.
Know what? She
he
was the presumptive candidate. She was the presumptive candidate 8 years ago as well.
Yeah, but he was
lost
employed
at the
by the
end.
Government,
right.
Michael.
Let me put it to you this way. Like I said, I never thought I would come forward with this. And when she was running before. I didn't really think she had a chance, because one of the first things I saw was former Senator Ted Kennedy endorsing Barack Obama, and I knew that it was over then. I get what you're saying, but this time I was pretty sure she was going to make it, and you know, she was going to run, and I do feel that strongly about it. I'm very clear about it in my book, and I got to tell you, I don't think you've read my book, so it's kind of hard to judge me on it.
Well, you know, I've got to be honest with you. I haven't read the book. I've only read the inserts, some of the excerpts of the book. But right. One of them that really gets me is mm-hmm. the whole Vince Foster incident and yeah. why you would bring that up again. Did yeah, you have some kind of special do you have some kind of special information to an incident that's been investigated now 5 times and no. there's been nothing found about it? So why bring that up?
Because it's important.
You have no agenda.
People need to know the way this poor guy was treated. He wanted nothing to do with Washington, D.C. Hey, let me ask you something. How many times did you see Vince Foster in the West Wing? How was his demeanor?
I never ran saw into him. The man. But I know right. but I know the
listen,
people that
don't
were
get the
in
wrong impression. Don't get the wrong impression. I wasn't his friend. But I stood for hours and hours and hundreds of hours, and I saw these people functioning back and forth. And I tell you the first thing, and let me tell you my first thought the first time I saw Vince Foster and I checked him into the West Wing. Was here's a guy I've never seen anybody in my life that didn't want to be somewhere. He was so uncomfortable there, and I realized obviously because he took his own life, he had some serious issues, and my heart goes out to his family. But I thought it was important to bring that forward because they couldn't. Here's the thing: my whole thing about the Clintons is, Bill or Mrs. Clinton is they go from one scandal to the next. She's already started the scandals, and she's not even anywhere near becoming president yet. It's just one scandal to the next, and one you know story swinging this way. It happened this way, and then it happened that way. Just look at the server deal with the State Department. That's a perfect example. I mean, poor Vince couldn't even kill himself and not turn it into a scandal because Mrs. Clinton sent one of her aides to his office to clear his office out. Do you know who Hank O'Neill is?
No, but no. I know who Maggie Williams is. She's an old
so
friend
Maggie
of mine.
Williams. So that's why, you know, it would have helped you to read the book because the book tells you about Hank Williams. And you can go online and C-SPAN and look up Hank Williams and see his testimony and how he got ripped apart because Maggie Williams went in and cleaned out Vince's office.
Well, they never proved that either.
Well, they didn't have to prove it. A sworn police officer told them what happened. But, of course, politics gets involved. And if they just go from one scandal to the next. One set of lies to the next, one set of spin to the next. Think, if you could not take all the scandals that involved the Clintons and put them on 2 sheets of paper, single space, it's incredible. And that's all. That's my fear. Let's get this out in the open. That's my fear. If she gets elected for the next 4 or 8 years, it will be one scandal to the next. I mean, how can they possibly give her a security clearance now?
Well, you know what? First of all these scandals you know, it all depends on your perspective, right? She didn't use her government server. The Justice Department has looked into that and said that there's nothing criminal. Okay,
that's
so there's
true.
Nothing criminal. Well, they just finished their investigation and they haven't indicted her on anything. And there's always one of these tomes. There's always one of these tomes that conservatives put out just prior to the election. When I worked for John Kerry, they had some guy who was in Vietnam write a book that said that this man with 3 Purple Hearts and a Silver Star was a coward, even though people stood up time after time and said that wasn't true. So
but that's
always
not on
one
both
of
sides,
these books.
Michael.
Right. But,
yeah.
Why did they say
but
that?
But there's one of these books always out there because they didn't
so
like
wait,
them.
Wait, we are running out of time.
Agenda.
Yeah.
And I want to give Gary Byrne, your book is called Crisis of Character. So if people, if they want to buy it and read it, they
Thank
can
you.
Find out on their own. What is true, though, is that Gary has been blocked out of mainstream media because apparently Drudge and Breitbart and Fox are the only outlets that you've been able to exploit. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's true. And I would suggest to you, listen, read my book. If it doesn't ring true to you, then it doesn't. But I'm telling you, it's what happened. It's my life. And another reason I wanted to tell this story, if I have a second, I want you to put yourself in my place where 4 years ago when my kids were 10 and 14, I had to sit them down in a computer and tell them they could never Google my name and look into the story about the Secret Service, because if they weren't careful, they would end up on a porn site. So I want you to think about that the next time you're criticizing my authenticity and my truth.
Well, I don't know whose name put you in on a porn site, but let me tell you, Maria, I think it speaks volumes and Breitbart and Trump and Fox are the only people pushing this, and the reason they are is because they have an agenda, and their agenda is to stop Hillary Clinton and get Donald Trump elected, and I think this man is part of it.
They're allowing me to express my First Amendment rights, and these other news agencies, listen. Good morning. What show's George Stephanopoulos on?
Today, I think. Yeah.
No. Good Morning America, right? Yeah. Oh, Good Morning America. I stood outside his office for over 2 years. The guy knows me as well as he knows anybody else that works there. You want to know if I was there and what I know? Go interview him, and he could have me on anytime he wants. He wants to, but he doesn't because he's afraid. Because he knows what I know, and he knows it's the truth.
Well, you've actually created more questions than you've provided answers, which is riveting and compelling and scary.
Yeah.
So, Gary, thank you.
I'm glad to do this anytime you want.
Yeah, and you know what? We appreciate having you, Gary.
Thank you.
You know, and maybe we need to have you back to discuss some more of this stuff. But
that's great.
A lot of it, I got to finish just by saying, a lot of it, I don't care that she swears at her husband. My wife is a librarian, and if they could hear some of the things she said to me, they would revoke her library card.
Sure.
Is part of being married.
I think
you're
missing the point, but I get what you're saying.
Yeah. Gary, thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. And I hope you have a great night. And please don't hesitate to reach out to my people. I'd love to do it again.
Perfect.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And that's
Bye-bye.
Gary Byrne. And that's the first time I've seen you that animated, Michael.
Well, you know, I really do think this man has a political agenda. But you know what? Our show is about giving people the right to come on and speak openly and freely about their views. And I think that's important for us to sit down and have a dialogue. And I don't think this man should be ignored. I think we should find out what he has to say and whether we really care about it. That's the big thing. I don't care whether Hillary Clinton shot a machine gun or whether she yelled at her husband.
Are just anecdotes.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it seems to be the substance of the book, though, from what I've read. But I got to read it. I got to be honest. All I'm hearing, all I'm seeing is excerpts from the book. I haven't read it, so maybe that'll be the next week or two before we ask him to come back on again. If we do, maybe I need to get a little more familiar with it, but it just seems like the same old to me. And so I don't give it much credibility, but.
Well, that's the whole point is that's America. You can choose for yourself, right?
Exactly right.
And we're
all forced to choose. Next week, folks, please join us because the Republican convention will be about to start. And I think there's a lot of things we want to talk about there. Will Newt Gingrich be the vice presidential?
We're going to be talking about who.
And then the following week, I'll be at the Democratic convention. So we'll want to talk about that, too.
Absolutely.
Okay. So thanks, Maria.
Of course. Have a great week. Thank you, listeners. We appreciate your ears.
Thank you, listeners. We'll see you next week.
Bye-bye. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.